Welcome. Good evening, Radio Land. And welcome to Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby at SFU up atop the mountain here. We are also on the internet at cjsf.ca. And finally, we're on channel HD 7014. I am live in the studio this week for 1 week only. It's reading break, and I thought I would come up and do a live show. It has been a little while since I've been able to actually be on the air the same time as my show and interviews. And speaking of shows and interviews, what a show there is for you today. We'll be speaking with author Alex Hawley, who delves into the world of settlers, pioneers, and frontiersmen, specifically the world of a very interesting character, Daniel Boone. He's one of those guys you learn about in high school in social studies class and history class, one of America's pioneers, but you don't really know much about him. There is so much mystery surrounding him, so much myth, so much man. Alex tries to tackle that in her debut novel, written from the point of view of Daniel Boone, surreptitiously titled "All True, Not a Lie" in it. So we'll get into that with her and sort of what intrigued her about Daniel Boone that she wanted to tell his story in a way. You'll also be hearing from Christopher Parsons, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Citizen Lab, as well as the managing director of the Transparency Project. And you'll hear from him talking about different acts of privacy, what the Snowden documents mean, but also holding government accountable and how the government agencies aren't required to legally state how much data about us they can obtain from these mega telecommunications committees. So it's a very interesting discussion. He's done a lot of research into that. So we'll be getting into that with him. But we're gonna have a few announcements to start off the show, and then you'll hear from the wonderful Alex Hawley. Be on the air, your voice with that station ID contest, so be sure to check that out. Also, if you're a big fan of radio like myself, be sure to check out World Radio Day. We have coverage for 12 hours from 5 to 5 this Friday the 13th here on CJSF. So in advance, happy World Radio Day. And now, my first guest is an author who is very intrigued by the frontier, pioneers, settling, and myths. And as a result, she has written a wonderful debut novel entitled All True, Not a Lie in it. And it tells the story of one famous frontiersman from the 1700s, Daniel Boone. I remember first hearing about Daniel Boone probably when I was, I don't know, 8 years old, I would say. And there's a lot of, he's one of those characters that there's a lot of stories about, but you don't know if they're true. The most famous one being when his body was moved from Missouri to Kentucky, and it's been said that the body in there is not actually him and his wife or him and his son, but a former slave. Alex Hawley has written about that in her new book, which is again called All True, Not a Lie in it, and I spoke to her earlier today from Kelowna. Alex Hawley, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the book is All True, Not a Lie in It.
Right.
And I read a little bit about your author's note, but tell us why Daniel Boone, for you, made a good story to tell.
Okay, that seems to be the $64,000 question, even for me. It's sort of hard to explain because I'm nothing like Daniel Boone. I mean, I'm female, vegetarian, I like my bed, I don't like camping, and he's sort of the hero of the early American frontier, right, and famous for trailblazing and hunting and opening up a path for white settlement into Kentucky. So where did that come from? Well, initially it came to me in the form of a memory of a picture from National Geographic, which I had last seen when I was, I think, 10. And a few years ago I was thinking about what I wanted to write next, and I had just finished my book of short stories. I thought I wanted to tackle a novel, and I was looking for a story, and that picture just kind of appeared out of nowhere as I was lying on the floor trying to think. And so I thought, I wonder if anybody has done this lately. I mean, I know there have always been stories about Daniel Boone, but I went and dug out National Geographic from the library. I still haven't returned it to the library. And looked at the picture and reread the article and thought how amazed I'd been by that story when I was 10. And was amazed all over again by Daniel's life story and what a wild tale it was. And perhaps amazed even more by the fact that nobody had recently written about it. So I felt in great luck.
Do you remember what it was specifically about that picture that caused you to remember it after all those years?
I was pregnant at the time, and a very nervous pregnant lady. It was my first pregnancy, and the picture I remembered is when Daniel is actually holding the body of his son, and I don't know if I had some kind of subconscious anxiety about having children, but that seems to be perhaps the connection, and in fact that's what the whole book hinges on, is the murder of Daniel's oldest son. So perhaps, yeah, there was some kind of connection in my mind there.
He's one of those people that, yes, he was a real person, but there's so much that is either not true or sort of exaggerated about his life and the things he did and his exploits. How did you go about separating that, or did you even bother to try?
It's really hard. When I eventually came up with the title, All True, Not a Lie in It, I thought I'm just going to have to be brazen about this. And just, there are so many lies in this because there have to be, for one thing. I mean, the historical record is pretty patchy. And as you say, there are a lot of things made up about him. Even when he was alive, people were making up stories about him, jumping over tall trees and leaping off cliffs that were 200 feet tall and surviving. So something about him, whatever it was, it seems to have inspired people to make up myths. And so once I got through some of the research and was kind of shaking my head, how am I going to do this? I just thought, well, I need to just continue making the myths because that's what's always been done. And Daniel himself seems to have thought it was pretty funny. The words, all true, not a lie, and it actually came from him after somebody wrote it's sort of a fake biography of him, or even an autobiography. They put words in his mouth, and he's reported to have laughed and said it was all true and there wasn't a lie in it. So I hope he would have been okay with this enterprise with what I've done.
I think one of the biggest mysteries or stories surrounding Daniel Boone is that of his grave in Kentucky, and the rumors that when it was dug up, it wasn't actually him buried in there.
Right.
In your research, what have you come across in regards to that story?
Oh, lots of fighting about it. He's got hundreds of descendants, right? He had so many children and siblings there, and there's a lot of very, very proud Boone descendants, and they're still sort of arguing over whether it's actually Daniel and his wife buried in that grave. As you mentioned, it was moved from its an original burial site in Missouri, when Kentucky decided that he really belonged to them. They dug up the burying ground and took two skeletons to this great monument site that they've built. And that actually really hooked me, too, and I would have loved to fit this into the novel, except it's first person, and I'm not sure how Daniel would be writing about his own grave. But I'm working on a sequel, and maybe I'll somehow be able to get that in. Have I found out any truth about that? I don't know. I think that the last word on that was one researcher thought that it could actually be the bones of a slave that were buried in the Kentucky grave at the monument in the end. So nobody really knows.
You mentioned that this is a first-person novel, and I'm curious about your process of writing not only from a man's perspective, but writing from the perspective of a man who was also a person of history.
Right. It wasn't easy, and I mean, I've written short stories from the male perspective before, and one of my workshop writing partners is male, and he always tells me off for things like, he says men don't run their hands along concrete walls, for one thing, so he tells me to cut out that kind of stuff. But I was pretty tentative about approaching, as you say, a famous historical figure's voice and a male voice, and it took me several drafts. I started out writing as a story of sort of a female researcher on the trail of Daniel Boone, and it was terrible and too distant. And then I did a third-person version of the draft, which was all he did this, he did that, and it still just felt too far away. And finally I just said, okay, I'm going to have to try the first person and see if it worked. And the voice actually came pretty quickly, I think, because I had done so much research and writing by then. So I felt I knew his character, at least as I'd created him. And so the voice sort of came to me at that point. I did worry about creating the voice of a historical figure, and I think my solution was to make it sound reasonably contemporary, as if you could be listening to this man talking right now. So I cut out a lot of the old-timey kind of speech, you know, these and thous and all that kind of thing. I wanted it to feel a little bit removed from the present, but believable, and as I say, yeah, like somebody you could be listening to now, and I hope I managed to get that across.
How does the first person storytelling change the flow and the style of the piece versus a third person narrative, say?
Well, it's really different, and it's a lot different, as I realized when I tried to push the third person into first person. First of all, because the first person, Daniel, the I, only has access to his own head, right? So we can only get his speculations about what other people are thinking. So we're really just stuck with his perspective. So there's that. You have to sort of figure out how to get information across when it's only what he would have known. So there was that. And all through my writing life, I've kind of resisted the first person. And I think my problem with it was, I found it always sounded phony because I wondered, who would this person be talking to? And I think any writer doing this has to answer that question. And for me, the answer was that he's talking to his dead, and I'm pretty upfront about that in the novel, that that's who he is telling this story to, because otherwise I sometimes think with big, long first-person novels, now who is this intended for? So once I had that, I think that was a key to going ahead with the first-person voice, too.
People, you know, there's Daniel Boone's definitely not the only frontiersman. There's a lot of other people of that era. But what was it about him that made him such a good, almost mythological hero, in a sense?
That's such a good and such a big question, and one that I kind of tried to resolve in the book. I'm not sure I've totally resolved it for myself yet. I've always been really interested in charismatic people. I know a few people, a handful of them, who just seem to have this magical magnetism that draws everyone to them, and love them or hate them, these are people who stir something up in you. And I get the feeling that Daniel was somebody like that, just because everybody who knew him seems to have remembered something about him, that he seems to have had this kind of aura or power or whatever you want to call it, something about his personality. And I talk about this in the foreword to the book a little bit, but I think some people like that have the ability to almost imprint themselves on not just people around them, but on time, if you will. There's something so kind of powerful and magical about who they were, so memorable, that they managed to make themselves mythical even when they're alive. So that was the answer I came up with as to why Daniel Boone, why does everyone remember him when they don't even know much about him?
And that broaches the larger question of sort of myths and folklore in general. Why do they make us feel good? Why are they such an important part of our culture, our history, our society?
I think that's just built into the human brain. I mean, if you read Carl Jung and on the collective unconscious, I've always been a pretty big subscriber to that theory that there is stuff that is just built into us and stuff that we're all looking for. And one of those things is story, because story helps us make sense of why we're here and what we're supposed to be doing. So I just think that's part of the human program, if you will.
The overall process of writing the book for you, I know you, obviously you had to do a lot of research into the life of Boone, but once you actually sat down and started writing, what was that process like?
Well, I actually had to cut myself off from research after a while. I love research. I'm an extreme nerd, if you haven't figured this out by now. And when I worked on my PhD in English Lit, I worked on the 19th century, and I got very heavily into things like, you know, shoe buttons and stuff like that. So you have to stop at some point. I think especially if you're trying to write fiction, because it's so easy to just turn it into and I picked up my spinning wheel, which was made of this type of wood and worked this way, and it just ends up being a kind of an encyclopedia of how life worked in those days. And especially with first person, you want it to feel natural. I mean, would Daniel Boone be sitting there talking about, and this was the way I did my hair that morning in the typical frontiersman style? No, he wouldn't, right? So you have to be able to get the details in kind of naturally. I think Graham Greene said something about when you're writing, you need to be able to know all the details of your world down to how the doorknobs would look. And I think I did just enough research to feel that I knew that world, that I could see it myself, and then hope that I could get it across in a natural way for readers.
That brings up an interesting point about, because of the fact you did so much research, did you ever consider this making a non-fiction story, a biography of Daniel Boone?
I did, because my background is academic, although I tend to prefer fiction writing. And when I was doing the third person version, the he version, I started to think this could just be a biography. But there are a couple of excellent, pretty modern biographies. One is just called Daniel Boone, and it's by John Mac Farragher, and it's just terrific. It's the known facts of his life alongside the myths about him. So he's done a great job, and that was very, very inspiring for me. So I thought, well, that's been done pretty recently, and I want to be able to take this character and run with him and get inside his head and try to imagine what it was like to be that kind of powerful and charismatic person in all these crazy and difficult situations he found himself in.
I know in this book that the Shawnee are mentioned, and there's been a lot of discussion lately about the Native Americans and the treatment of them over history. Christopher Columbus is a perfect example of that.
Right.
Where did you find that relationship, you know, Daniel Boone and his relationship to the First Nations peoples?
It's almost unbelievable what happened, and the second part of the book covers this. Well, Daniel and his party of white settlers were encroaching onto First Nations hunting grounds that hadn't really been given up in any treaties, that they knew they weren't supposed to be there, and yet they went anyway, like a lot of white settlers were doing at the time. So obviously they were under attack by the First Nations people there, and Daniel actually was kidnapped by a party of Shawnee and taken back to the Shawnee winter town of Chillicothe and lived with them for several months, and was, instead of being executed, as you might imagine, was actually adopted into a Shawnee family and made part of the tribe. So I found that so fascinating and so unbelievably generous that the Shawnee would do this under the circumstances. And it was a fairly standard practice that they would adopt captives to replace some lost warriors. So, yeah, the fact that they would sort of take him in and make him one of them was just stunning to me, and was also a pretty bold contrast to the treatment of a lot of the Shawnee people and the other tribes by the settlers at the time. I think Daniel really gravitated towards that kind of life, perhaps more than the settled life, and so it was interesting for me to explore how he felt when he was living with them, and his sort of imagination about what would life be if I could just stay here.
There's always, you know, interesting discussions about you know, colonialism and what is colonialism versus the rights of First Nations. If Daniel Boone were sort of living in today's age, if you will, what do you think he would make of that debate?
I think he was very, perhaps uncommonly for the time, sympathetic to the plight of the First Nations people. But at the same time, I think he wanted to go where he wanted to go. He wasn't so much about settlement, at least in my view, as exploration. So, you know, the fact that he was dragging his family around with him was almost an afterthought to him, and that they would need homes and places to stay permanently. That doesn't seem to have, occurred to him all that strongly some of the time. So, I think he was caught in a kind of a bind, a fantasy of living this kind of woodland life, just exploring wherever he wanted to go, living this kind of nomadic existence that some of the First Nations tribes did, at least in the hunting times, and, you know, having a wife and children and a home for them. So what would he make of the situation now? I think he would sort of wish that things could have stayed the way they were in this idealized vision of North America as a wilderness, you know, where people were free to come and go and move and keep on finding new places.
You mentioned you're working on a sequel. How much of Daniel Boone's story do you have left to tell?
Well, he's about 45 when this one ends, and actually the adventure only gets bigger from here in his life. So I'm very, very excited to keep going. There's a lot of kind of action coming up, and he lived to be a very old man for the time. He lived to be 80. So I think there's lots more material, and I'm pretty thrilled to be able to work on it.
Do you think you'll tell any stories of his compatriots, people like Davy Crockett, Billy the Kid, Jesse James?
Well, they're all a little later, but I'm pretty into this frontier life now. And as I said before, 19th century was always my thing before I went back to the 18th. So I would love to. I actually have a Victorian ghost story in the works too. So maybe I'll manage to work in, Buffalo Bill or somebody like that.
Well, the book is all true, not a lie in it. The fictionalized story, semi-fictional story, of the life of Daniel Boone. It's a great, great novel. Alex Hawley, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Dan. It's been great.
Cheers. Take care.
Thanks.
And that was Alex Hawley. Once again, her debut novel is All True, Not a Lie in It, and covers the life, at least up until the age of 45, of the pioneersman Daniel Boone. And this is Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, up atop the mountain here at Simon Fraser University. It's starting to rain again, so stay warm, people. We're going to be getting a lot of rain in the coming weeks and days. In addition, if you're more technological, you can listen to us on the internet at cjsf.ca, where we stream and podcast all your favorite CJSF shows, including yours truly. As well, you can listen on TELUS HD channel 7014. All right, we're going to play a quick piece of music here and then get to our interview with Christopher Parsons. This is Willie Mitchell with Call of the Moose.
Oh.
That was Willie Mitchell with Call of the Moose, and that's off a really great compilation album called Native North America, Volume 1, Aboriginal Folk, Rock, and Country, 1966 to 1985. It's a two-CD set, and Willie Mitchell's one of the greatest Aboriginal artists this country has seen, but we also have Willie Dunn, Eric Landry, John Angiak, Lloyd Chichu, the Chieftones. So check it out. It's a really, really great album. Okay. Well, you heard me talk about him earlier, and my next guest is a postdoctoral fellow at the Citizen Lab. As well, he is also the managing director of the Transparency Project, which looks at a lot of privacy issues, but also government responsibility for data collection in regards to telecommunication and stuff like that. It's a very important discussion that not a lot of people are talking about. And it's something that needs to be talking about. And, you know, he spent the last, you know, at least decade or so looking into it. And you can visit him at his website, christopher-parsons.com, or the Citizen Lab, which is part of the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, the managing director of the Telecom Transparency Project. He is Christopher Parsons, and he joined me on the phone from Victoria earlier today. Hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you are with Citizen Lab, and you're also the managing director of the Transparency Project. What can you tell us about the where did the concept of the Transparency Project come from?
So the Telecom Transparency Project is really born out of many years of frustration. Many advocates, many scholars, even some members on government and opposition benches have really had these questions as to how often and for what reasons do domestic authorities, so both sort of the RCMP, but also CSIS and CRA and CBSA and, you know, all the other acronyms that make up our federal government, how often are they accessing the private information stored by telecommunications companies, that private information of Canadians? And so I joined the Citizen Lab about a year and a half ago and just really ran with this project to do everything we could to start putting real evidence and real numbers on the table, with the goal of not necessarily shaming companies or anything like that, but really just to help everyone in Canada get an understanding of the degree or the extent of surveillance that's going on. And that, because it's really helpful for when we say, you know, there's new anti-terror legislation or new security legislation, it helps us put in context whether or not the government already has substantive access to telecommunications data, or whether they might actually, you know, legitimately need more. And so it's really an effort to put, you know, data and evidence on the table.
And how much of the conversation that we're having about, you know, government transparency and in telecommunications, how much of that is because of Edward Snowden?
So I think that Edward Snowden's disclosures have been incredibly helpful in sort of queuing up the public and parliamentarians alike. But the work that we've primarily done as part of the Telecom Transparency Project is understanding how domestic authorities gain access to telecommunications data in Canada. And so while at the Citizen Lab we are engaged and we analyze the Snowden documents that pertain to Canada as well as other international audiences, the Telecom Transparency Project is really focused more than anything else on that domestic collection of personal information by the government.
Now you said here, I'm reading one of your articles on the Citizen Lab site, and it says that government agencies are not legally required to disclose the full extent to which they conduct telecommunications-related surveillance. So what are the current laws surrounding telecommunications data collection?
Surrounding how the telecommunications companies collect it, or surrounding how the government gains access to telecommunications?
Surrounding how the government obtains access to it.
Right. So there's a few different mechanisms that are pretty commonly used. So there's what are called interception warrants, and these are sort of the classic wiretap warrants that we imagine. And those are reported every year by both provincial or to the provincial legislatures and to the federal government. And so that's really, you know, how many times people are listening in on your phone calls or watching your internet traffic in real time. But there's a whole bunch of other kinds of data access. And so, you know, just a couple of them. You can install what are called number dialer recorders. And what that really means is with this kind of a warrant, a government agency will be able to see the numbers that you're typing into your phone and who's dialing you. Now, in the United States, what it looks as though is that kind of power is taken from, you know, punching numbers into a telephone to a broader collection of the non-content of communications. And so it's been used to sort of for mass surveillance of tracking, you know, dozens or hundreds of people in one location with a cell phone on the basis that there's a questionable legal argument, but on the basis that there's an analogy between tracking phones sort of in a public space and gaining this number dialer recorder information. But in Canada, we have no public numbers on how often government authorities use this warranting power, or indeed the extent to which they use it. We've also seen previously law enforcement, especially in Ontario, have received warrants for what are called tower dumps. And so when you have a mobile phone, it connects to all of the cell towers around you on a very regular basis. So, you know, you can send phone calls, and so you can receive them and access the internet and all that sort of stuff. And so these tower dumper orders, they in some cases revealed, you know, tens of thousands of Canadians' personal information when law enforcement was, you know, really trying to find one person and they weren't sure who they were looking for. You also have what are called subscriber information requests. And so historically, this has meant one of two things. Either a law enforcement or other government agency would go to a court and they say, hey, we have this identifier. We'd like to go to Rogers or Bell or Shaw to figure out who it belongs to. Or what they could do prior to a Supreme Court decision last year, actually, is they could just write a letter to any of the telecommunications companies in Canada. They could say, you know, we want to learn who this phone number belongs to. Can you tell us? And in many cases, the telecommunications companies in Canada would just turn that information over, even without a court warrant. So those are just a couple of the ways. But of all the ways I've just mentioned, the only one that is recorded is interceptions. And the only other way that a Canadian citizen or resident of Canada would know that these powers had been used against them is, you know, if it turned up in a court of law and it was introduced as evidence. So we're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands or you know, over a million people have had their information on average accessed every year. And either Canada has far more criminality than most Canadians believe, or there's a whole lot of data being collected about Canadians by government agencies, and Canadians just never know the true scope of government surveillance.
Now, obviously there has to be a line between, you know, data collection and surveillance and the government spying on its citizens. So where would you draw the line? What would be an acceptable thing for the government do in terms of how they approach their telecommunications data?
So I think the very first thing that's important is, so the Solicitor General standards that report these wiretap numbers or these interception numbers, there have been many instances where the Government of Canada has introduced new security or policing legislation, and yet they've never included true updated accountability mechanisms with it. So just to begin with, it'd be very helpful to know how often these number dialer warrants are issued, how many times subscriber data is requested, and things of that nature. And indeed, you know, revealing it at an aggregate number, the amount of surveillance, doesn't endanger any investigations, because it doesn't say that Chris Parsons was monitored or something like that. It's just, you know, 5,000 Canadians or 50,000 Canadians or 500,000 Canadians were affected by this kind of surveillance. And then the interception warrants also describe, and this is how many times that led to a conviction and the kind of conviction. And so it's really helpful from a public policy standpoint, because we can see how much surveillance is or is not going on, and we can see if it works. I mean, if it turns out that there were 1.2 million requests for subscriber data last year, and there was that many a few years back, and yet only, you know, 100 or 200 people have charges brought against them, and even fewer than that go to court and receive a conviction, then I think that the Canadian public is well situated to say, well, hold on, I think there's a whole lot of disproportionate surveillance going on. And so the very beginning stage is just transparency and accountability. The government owes it to Canadians to explain how it is intruding upon their privacy and their communications independence. And it's not that hard to do. We have the mechanisms set up. The government has just unfortunately decided that it's not a priority item for them.
But is there a limit to someone's privacy or to a country's privacy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the courts have stated time and time and time again that, you know, privacy, your right to privacy is not absolute, just like your freedom of speech is not absolute. And that's what the warranting process is all about. The legitimate ability to intrude on someone's privacy to monitor their communications because you believe that there is some degree of criminality or other activity going on that, you know, the state has to identify to respond to. So it isn't that privacy is absolute, but when an individual's private communications or personal information is intruded upon, I think that it behooves the government to, A, notify the individuals affected after a period of time, and that's what happens when you know, your phone is tapped after 6 months or a year or sometimes a little bit more, you will be told by the government that, hey, we were listening to your phone, even if a criminal charge isn't forthcoming. And so I think we could do that. And then the other thing is have these aggregate numbers, so it puts it in context. So it isn't just me receiving a private letter, but it's in fact the Canadian public understanding that, you know, there is a great deal or a moderate deal or a very low deal of communications interception and monitoring. So you're absolutely correct. Privacy is an absolute, and you know, Canadians shouldn't expect that. But they should expect that when the government intrudes on their privacy, that they're notified of that intrusion.
Now, that brings up the question, is there anything that the Canadian public can do to avoid their privacy being invaded in these specific ways?
Well, the mechanisms that I'm identifying are legal instruments. And so this is the government, you know, going and getting a legal warrant from, signed off usually by a judge or a justice. And so in terms of avoiding, you know, there are various technologies that you could do to make it more challenging for the government to monitor you, but at least in theory, the kind of surveillance that is ongoing is meant to be legitimate. Now, if Canadians are concerned about sort of the lack of transparency, or they think the degree of surveillance that they're learning about right now is overbroad, then sort of as a political scientist, I would always recommend, you know, contact MPs. Actually write an MP and say, I have concerns or issues. The problem with privacy in Canada is it's very rarely a voting issue, and it's very rarely a high priority amongst politicians. You know, there's the economy, national defense, and everything else. And it's only when politicians realize that there are votes at stake that they're going to be more likely to respond to Canadians' concerns.
And I'm wondering, you know, we're living in such a, you know, a technological, in such a digital age, and how much has the expansion of the internet change not only our privacy, but everyone else's approach to privacy?
Well, obviously, the advent of social networking and the fairly ready accessibility of broadband has meant that more people are sharing more information in a public or semi-public way than ever before in history. However, there's a misconception amongst some members of the federal government, as well as, you know, some Canadians, that simply because you do something online that you've lost a privacy interest. And in Canada, we have a nuanced set of laws that, A, assert from the Supreme Court that Canadians have a right to keep secrets online, they have a right to anonymity online, and simply because you, say, post something on Twitter even, it doesn't mean you have no privacy a reasonable expectation of privacy in what you tweet, because there's you expect that information to be used in some ways and not others. And so to put that in, make that a little clearer, let's say I tweet something. The federal government of Canada is not permitted under the Federal Privacy Act to just hoover up all of my tweets unless they have a clear purpose and they have to explain that and state it and they have to have a process in place. And so simply because information is public even doesn't mean it's readily accessible to government or any other party for that matter. So the extent to which we enjoy privacy has changed. And so whereas once we might not have said something, now we just assume that when we say it, it won't be used in a way we don't intend. And the law has to some extent kept pace, with the challenge being is whenever the government or indeed a corporation, you know, goes a little bit further than Canadians want or expect, you have to go to court to sort of reassert that right to privacy, even when you're in a public or semi-public space.
You mentioned briefly there that some people believe they have a right to anonymity. And a lot of people have had said that the rampant cyberbullying we're seeing these days, you know, Amanda Todd, Rehtaeh Parsons, is because the cyberbullies think that they have a right to being anonymous. So do you think that if people were required to post their own names on these forums, on chat rooms, on Reddit and stuff like that, we would see a decrease in these incidences?
So just on the point of the right to anonymity, I mean, that's from the Supreme Court of Canada. And so it's not an opinion. It's a legal assertion. Now, rights are not absolute. And of course, you know, a right to anonymity can be intruded upon if police have legitimate reasons to re-identify individuals. As to your broader question is, you know, if we all have our names attached to what we say online, will that make you know, cyberbullying go away? The answer is quite flatly no. So, sadly, there are cases all around the world where real name policies have been established, and there was no measurable decrease in, you know, online cyberbullying or threats or something of that nature. There's a broader difficulty in just educating people or reminding people when they go to type something on a screen that there's someone on the other side. And even where you do have real name policies, they tend to be very easy to get around if you're even just moderately savvy. And I'm not talking about, you know, you're a computer scientist or you're a hacker or something like that. It's, if you know how to use Google and you're willing to spend 5 minutes searching, you can usually find a way around those real name policies. So they don't measurably reduce cyberbullying in most contexts, and in very specific ones they may. And the other challenge that you run into is all of a sudden, individuals' names are attached to things. So they may be unwilling to say things that could be valuable and could contribute to a discussion or a debate, but they might be unwilling to on the basis that they're worried that if they say it, it could come back and it could haunt them in the future. And so it actually chills speech of, I would argue more often than not, people who are well-meaning, and it doesn't necessarily chill the speech of those who are saying things who would want to have their speech chilled.
And I also wanted to ask you briefly about, you mentioned here on your website the SIGINT summaries, Canada's Foreign National Signals Intelligence Agency.
Yep.
What is going on with that? There's been some concern that they're not necessarily doing things the way they should be.
So on my website, so www.christopher-parsons.com, I've set up a series, I've identified all of the documents pertaining to the Communications Security Establishment, so Canada's Signals Intelligence Agency, and just described what those documents say. And so there's been a series of real concerning pieces that have come out. So one that broke last year identified that CSE was collecting the metadata, so not the words of your email, but all the identifiers associated with your email. So your email name, maybe the subject line, bits of data like that. And it was collecting metadata writ generally in order to track individuals as they moved around Canada. Now, this was part of a test, but the Signals Intelligence Agency is supposed to focus outside of Canada and is barred from directly targeting Canadians. And so what we learned as a result of that is that CSE and its overseeing commissioner believe that CSE is permitted to collect this metadata. And you know, metadata is the bread and butter of signals intelligence. It's how everything works. And so basically what it means is that Canadians are indeed seeing their personal information massively collected by our communications signals establishment. We've also found out more recently, in the past month, that file upload sites were monitored as well. And so quite often you get music artists or groups like that that would put up their own music, as well as, you know, individuals who were pirating that music or engaging in copyright infringement. But all of those file upload sites were being monitored. And so every person who was downloading everything from Glee to terrorist training manuals were being logged by CSE. And while CSE, you know, was ultimately identified about 350 events a month that they were interested in, every day they were collecting 10 to 15 million. And there's no evidence that they were removing that data. Now, it affected not just Canadians, but indeed the world writ large, but certainly Canadians were caught up in that net. And there's no evidence that CSE has purged Canadian data or indeed any person's data from those databases. So we're seeing, you know, truly global collection of information in very opaque ways. And on the one hand, signals intelligence is just to learn how the world works and to advise government, but we also share this information with our Five Eyes partners, including organizations such as the CIA. And so it's not just listening, it's listening with the intent of taking some sort of action afterwards.
And finally, you mentioned near the beginning about the new anti-terror legislation that the government has introduced. How is that new legislation going to affect our privacy as citizens?
That's a really good question. And myself and others are continuing to analyze the legislation to give a good answer. The most significant concern or worry or risk associated with that legislation from my perspective right now is it will make criminal the interference of certain systems that are often monitored in the course of research. And so as an example, if you're a security researcher and you're looking at the publicly available data on, say, a city's online vote system, and so you look at it, you don't hack it, you just look at it, and then you identify flaws and vulnerabilities, there is some concern amongst members of the research community that doing so could constitute a threat against the security of Canada. And that's someone who isn't trying to damage the vote, but is actually trying to improve the security of those systems. So that isn't a direct privacy threat, but it does mean that those who are researching security to make sure that all of our communications are more private may be unable to do that research. And if so, then we'll all have less privacy because we'll be less secure on the internet.
Well, it's definitely an issue that needs to be talked about more in society. You can visit the Citizen Lab at citizenlab.org, or, of course, Christopher Parsons also has his own website at christopher-parsons.com. He is the managing director of the Transparency Project. Christopher Parsons, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, cheers. Have a good one.
Cheers.
That was Christopher Parsons, managing director of the Telecom Transparency Project and a postdoctoral fellow of the Citizen Lab, the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. And I spoke to him earlier today from good old Victoria. CGSF.ca and TELUS HD channel 7014. Yes, here at CGSF, we put our interns on the air because we can. Thank you to the lovely Maddie.
You're welcome.
For that. And gentlemen, she's got great hair. This has been Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM. Thanks to my guests, Alex Hawley. Her new book is All True, Not a Lie in It, about Daniel Boone. My thanks to Christopher Parsons of the Telecom Transparency Project and Citizen Lab at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. My guests next week will be Larry Sims, the editor of Guantanamo Diary, and Phil Zuckerman, who authored a piece about secular families being more happier and more moral than those who were raised religious. We are going to take you out now with another song from our lovely album, Native North America Volume 1, Aboriginal Rock, Folk, and Country, from 1966 to 1985. This is Suglock with I Didn't Know. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.